Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much power does the U.S. Border Patrol wield, and how far into the interior of the country does that authority extend? The United States employed just 4,000 Border Patrol agents in 1994. Today, there are more than five times that many, and its parent agency, Customs and Border Protection, has a total of 60,000 officers in the field. Those expanded numbers now make the CPB, the nation's CBP, the nation's largest security agency, with a larger budget than all other federal law enforcement programs combined. And as my guest today will tell us, border security officers can now be found working quite far from our actual borders and carrying out warrantless searches and other tactics prohibited for employees of other law enforcement agencies. Todd Miller is a journalist specializing in border issues. His new book is called Border Patrol Nation: Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. Todd, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really think the current size and scope of Customs and Border Protection will take many people by surprise. Can you fill us in on how it's grown so much since the 90s?
Sure thing. Well, if you look at the 1990s, like you just mentioned, and actually if you look at U.S. Border Patrol, just specifically at the U.S. Border Patrol, when it was formed in 1924, there was probably just a little bit under 1,000 agents. From 1924 to around 1994, it grew from about 1,000 to 4,000. And then, after operations, most Operation Hold the Line, Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Safeguard, these are all operations that happened in the mid-1990s, which concentrated resources and more agents in urban areas along the U.S.-Mexico border. After those operations in 1994 and combined with the post-9/11 era, you see the growth that you just mentioned from 4,000 to approximately 21,000 to 22,000. Of course, before 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security did not exist. After 9/11, that's when Customs and Border Protection, CBP, was formed, which is an agency that's under the Department of Homeland Security, and Border Patrol is a part of CBP. CBP now is around. They're hiring too, so they're expanding even more. They just issued a notification that they'll be hiring 2,000 more officers, but now they're around 60,000, and it's a significant number because it's double. You can look at it a number of ways, but one way to look at it, it's double the size of Ecuador's army.
What is the official role of CBP in national security and law enforcement? What is it tasked with?
So if you simply go to CBP's website, you'll see the priority mission, that their priority mission is to stop terrorists and weapons of mass destruction from entering the United States. That's alongside traditional missions of immigration enforcement and drug interdiction, and to facilitate trade. So those are But the key thing that has shifted from the pre-9/11 era, and that was when INS, or Immigration and Naturalization Service, was more the agency in charge of our ports of entry. The key change is a terrorism mission. It definitely has a number one counterterrorism mission.
Have they intercepted a lot of would-be terrorists at the borders?
What has been documented up to this point, there has not been one person who's been affiliated with a terrorist organization who has been apprehended publicly. Publicly in the sense that they have not said publicly that they've apprehended any sort of terrorist. The person that's usually brought up is an incident that happened pre-9/11, and that was the so-called millennial bomber who was coming across the border he was trying to cross the border from Canada to the United States through a port of entry in Washington State. And he apparently had a bomb in his car, and he was going to try to do something on Y2K or when it turned to year 2000, he had some sort of plan, or at least that's what we were told. So that's the one person that's referenced.
You actually grew up along the Canadian border on the U.S. side, which is not, by the way, a border people ordinarily think of when they picture Border Patrol. What were crossings like back then to and from the U.S. and Canada, and how have they changed?
So one of the classic incidents that happened in Congress in the post-9/11 era was a congressperson, I can't remember his name right now, but he came to a hearing and he had an orange cone in his hand, and he held up the orange cone to everyone and he said, "This is what our border security looks like on the Canadian border." And it's true to an extent. Of course, growing up, I crossed into Canada and back into the United States, and there were ports of entry, and I don't remember once, you know, if I went into Canada, I'd have to talk to customs officials going into Canada. If I had to go in the United States, same thing. However, what his point was is that we need more security on the Canadian border. And if you even look at the 2001 USA Patriot Act, it mandated a 300% increase of resources and personnel to the Canadian border. And then more legislation in 2004 mandated that all, and this is when Border Patrol started this massive recruiting effort, and they were going from 12,000 agents to 18,000 agents, but it mandated that 20% of all agents would be stationed on the U.S.-Canada border. So you've seen a rate of growth on the Canadian border that's much higher than the southern border. There's still, if you look at the U.S.-Mexico border, there are many more agents, much more of the kind of enforcement apparatus there for sure. However, the rate of growth on the Canadian border has been higher, and of course the Canadian border is 4,000 miles long from Washington State to Maine, so it's almost double the size of the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, I actually moved as a teenager to the Mexican border, and I lived in El Paso. And at the time, and I'm 43, so this tells you 30 years ago, crossing was pretty casual. You did have to say that you were an American. But it definitely seemed that any kind of stops were much more about searching for contraband than about keeping individuals in or out of one country or the other.
Right. So it's definitely shifted. In El Paso, the El Paso Juarez border actually was one of the places where you could see kind of the modern blueprint of the policy shifts that we see. It was in El Paso where Operation Hold the Line took hold in 1992, and that significant border policy shift where agents were then put side by side by side by side by side on the borderline. And then eventually the wall, you know, our fencing came in with eventually more concentration of technology and more, like you say, this idea of an apparatus of exclusion, rather than, though contraband, searching for contraband is definitely one of their priority missions.
Tell us a little bit about the jurisdiction of Border Patrol agents, where they can operate, what they can do.
So the jurisdiction of Border Patrol agents, and this is a real interesting fact, they have jurisdiction from the actual international boundary line, then 100 miles from there into the interior of the country. So you take the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border, 100 miles in up to the north, and that's the Border Patrol's jurisdiction. If you take the 4,000-mile U.S.-Canadian border, 100 miles to the south from the Canadian boundary, and this includes the coast. Officially, the U.S. international boundary is 12 miles out to sea. So from 100 miles from that 12-mile point is where Border Patrol could operate within the coast. And if you in the coastal areas, I mean, so if you take that area, and of course, Border Patrol is not working in all those areas, but if you take that area, the jurisdiction covers 2/3 of where the U.S. population lives. And if you look at that area, and there's the ACLU has designed a map showing a band going across the contour of the United States. And you'll see that the band is like a gray band showing their jurisdiction. You'll see that it devours the entire state of Florida, for example. It devours the entire state of Maine. So it's covering a significant part of the United States. And what the ACLU calls it is they call it a constitution-free zone. What they mean by that is that in these areas, Border Patrol, as a federal law enforcement agency, operates with extra constitutional powers, meaning they can do things above and beyond what local law enforcement can do. And one thing that you see very commonly where I live, which is southern Arizona, are checkpoints and checkpoints where, you know, you get stopped at a checkpoint. An agent will, you know, he can surveil the car with his eyes. He can ask you a question about your citizenship. And if anything raises his or her suspicions, then they can pull you over into secondary and search your car or ask you more questions, even a full interrogation, that sort of thing. They can pull you over for on suspicion alone. They can enter property within 25 miles of the border without a warrant, and they can actually search through your car without a warrant. So there are things that they can do that are above and beyond what normal law enforcement can do.
My guest is Todd Miller. He's a journalist specializing in border issues and author of Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Frontlines of Homeland Security. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to update you on the status of our challenge for today. We have 199 contributions left to go in order for KERA to receive an additional $2,000. You can really help with this when you make your contribution now at kera.org or 888-694-6931. You can receive a thank you gift copy of Todd Miller's new book, Border Patrol Nation, if you'd like. We have that available for anybody who makes a gift of $120 or more. KERA reporter Lauren Silverman is back with us now. Hi, Lauren.
Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
Very well.
Well, that I was just listening to that conversation. Really interesting to learn a little bit more about Border Patrol and how it extends far beyond what we typically may think of as the border. And we don't often hear about the border on Canada's end. So that's also another interesting facts. If you get little snippets of information that you find yourself telling your friends or family during dinner or maybe over coffee, say, oh, yeah, did you hear this thing I heard on KERA? I find myself doing it all the time. You, whether you realize it or not, are part of this KERA family. And as part of the family, we invite you to become a sustaining member by giving really any amount, as low as $5 a month. You can go up to as high as you want. And by becoming a sustaining member, there are goodies that you get, but you also can have that little piece of knowledge in the back of your mind, knowing that you are fully supporting your public radio station and all of those little facts and snippets and stories that you get from listening to our shows are partially owned by you. So please call us at 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org.
Lauren, of course, works for us here at KERA, but has stories on NPR National News all the time. She had a story this morning on Morning Edition. You are helping to be a benefactor of this kind of quality journalism being produced in North Texas, but of sufficient quality and interest to be broadcast around the United States. It's something to be proud of. If you are a member, pat yourself on the back. And if you are not yet a member, join us and join KERA. Become part of the formula that makes public radio possible by making a gift of support at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. We will be back in about 2 minutes talking more about Border Patrol Nation with Todd Miller.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Todd Miller, author of the new book Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. One of the places you went, Todd, was a sort of an expo, a conference where people who are involved in the border security industry get together to show off their wares. Can you talk about what you found there?
Sure. Yeah, as part of my research, I went to a number of different trade shows. And one, the biggest one in the United States is called the Border Security Expo. It happens every year, usually in March in Phoenix, Arizona. And it takes place at a convention hall. It's a big conference where all kinds of high officials from Border Patrol, from Homeland Security, from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, from Customs and Border Protection, they go there and have a conference. But also there's an exposition hall where usually more than 120 different companies come and show their wares, their technologies. For example, when you go into the Phoenix Convention Center, you go into the convention hall, you'll see the high ceilings, you'll see, you know, the banners of different companies that are there. You'll probably companies that many people recognize, like Lockheed Martin, like Raytheon, like Boeing. And probably up on the ceiling, you'll also see a surveillance balloon. The surveillance balloon, they're called aerostats. They're generally connected with, you know, high powered cameras, which are something that CBP is looking for always. And then, for example, I'll talk to different vendors, and one of the vendors I talked to was one who was selling surveillance balloons. And he said, well, with that camera on the bottom of that surveillance balloon way over on the other corner of the convention hall, I can read what's on your notebook. I can read the rating that's on your notebook. And I said to him, no way, you can't do that. And so he started kind of manipulating the camera with his kind of like an Xbox controller. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, within, you know, about 1 minute or about 30 seconds, up on a monitor on my right-hand side were the words on my notebook. So that's the kind of technologies, these really sophisticated high-tech technologies, and it's lots of different companies that are looking to what people are calling a border security market and a growing border security market. It's projected to be growing at about a 5% clip.
And it's not just the United States. This is a global market now.
It is truly a global market. One global projection for what they call the Homeland Security and Emergency Management market, which is a lot of border security stuff, is $544 billion for the year 2018. And that's looking at not only the U.S.-Mexico border, the U.S.-Canada border, but it borders different international boundaries everywhere in the world. In fact, one big statistic is that U.S. Border Patrol, our Border Patrol agents, have gone to more than 100 different countries and given trainings on border security and how to trainings to help countries, you know, develop their own border patrols.
Are those methods, I mean, are those other countries essentially doing the same things that the United States is doing? Are we not so unusual, perhaps, in the way we defend our borders?
It definitely is modeling. I would say, like I did in Border Patrol Nation, I went one chapter I dedicate to looking at this issue, and I'd go to the Dominican, the border between the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and of course they share the same island in the Caribbean, and they didn't have a Border Patrol before 2006, but a team of U.S. experts went to the Dominican Republic. They issued a report. They said, well, we think that there's things going across that border and that Dominican Republic needs its own border patrol. Then the president of the Dominican Republic issued a presidential decree. They formed their border patrol. They got resources from the United States. They received training from the U.S. Border Patrol. So now when I was there, doing my research, what you see is not exactly like the U.S.-Mexico border, probably a rudimentary version of it, but they had sort of protest barricades lined up almost like a wall, a mini wall, right on the boundary line between the DR and Haiti. And there were the border guard, the you could call the Border Patrol agents, the Dominican Border Patrol agents, were sitting on their X's, much like U.S. Border Patrol agents, which means that they sit behind the wall, or in this case, like the protest barricades, and they monitor a section of that wall, and then another one is maybe about 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet down, and then it goes on and on, and with roving patrols behind. So you see, like, maybe the blueprint of what we see on the U.S.-Mexico border, but it definitely seems to be influenced by that. And you talk to them, and have you met anyone from the U.S. Border Patrol? And almost everyone will say, yeah, we've got trainings.
Okay, Todd, I am no expert in navigation, but I do know that North Texas is far from the border, far more than 100 miles. What was the Border Patrol doing here when we had the Super Bowl in this part of Texas?
So in the Super Bowl, this is another post-9/11 sort of task that the Border Patrol has had. So this is every single Super Bowl from 2002 on, and it doesn't matter the geographic location of where it is, whether it's in Dallas, whether it's in Indianapolis, whether it's, you know, 500 miles from the border. They are part of a joint task force mission, which is a mission of Border Patrol, it's CBP, it's other Homeland Security agencies, along with local law enforcement, that will create a kind of perimeter surveillance, like almost as if they're transferring the international boundary, and they create a surveillance, a perimeter surveillance area, and in that area, they will patrol that area. And it's mainly because by their own words is that the Super Bowl is perceived to be a potential target if somebody were to attack the United States. It's such a big symbolic thing that the Super Bowl could be a potential target for a terrorist attack. So that is the reasoning behind the Border Patrol. So you'll see green uniformed officers or agents that you would normally see, you know, in Laredo or somewhere much south of Dallas, in Dallas, helping pretty much guard the borders around what the Super Bowl is.
When they set up those perimeters, do they carry their special permissions with them?
What do you mean by special permission?
The ability to do, say, 25 miles from the border, to be on private property, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, for example, the whole idea of now this the one Super Bowl, one of the Super Bowls that I was looking at was one that took place in Miami, and one of the Border Patrol missions with that particular Super Bowl was to go to the Greyhound station and go to the Amtrak station and get on the train and get on the bus, or the buses and the trains, and what they would do is go from person to person to person and ask them their citizenship. And then kind of that, it's a similar thing that you would see at a checkpoint. So if anything was to raise suspicions, they could pull you off either the train or the bus. So extra constitutional might, you could say, do apply.
How do long-serving Border Patrol agents feel about the ways that their organization has evolved and their responsibilities have expanded?
Oh, so I imagine you get varying opinions from long, you know, Border Patrol agents that have been around for a long time. I've heard a range of opinions myself. One agent that I interviewed, a retired agent who I interviewed in Niagara Falls, was you know, describing when he was working for the agency in the 1980s and 1990s up into the early 2000s. And there was about five agents, or, you know, a very small number of agents working out of the Niagara Falls station. And he when I was interviewing him, he told me with a great deal of surprise, you know, now there's, I can't remember the number he said, but it was significantly more than maybe 40, 50 some agents in the Niagara Falls station. And he looks at me and he says, what are they all going to do? You know, it's kind of, at least in his case, it was somewhat baffling, you know. And then you hear other long-term Border Patrol agents who worry about, you know, there's been so many people, so many new hires. So the agency has expanded so much in so little time that you hear some old-timers that worry about the new agents, but I don't want to generalize in any sort of way, but I've heard that from some people.
That the culture is changing of the organization.
Yeah, that the culture is changing, yeah.
My guest is Todd Miller. He's a journalist specializing in border issues, and he has a new book out called Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. We'll come back to our conversation in a few minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or, of course, you can always send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We do have thank you gift copies of Todd Miller's new book, Border Patrol Nation, available today. They are there for the taking when you make a contribution of $10 a month or more. That is a sustaining membership. You can do it all at once if you choose at $120. We have other thank you gifts as well. No matter what, if you make your contribution today, either online or over the phone, you'll be in this drawing to possibly win a pair of tickets to see Aretha Franklin. I have never seen her live, Lauren Silverman, who has just joined me.
I have never seen her either. I would love to, though.
I think she'd be amazing.
I mean, how could she not be amazing?
Right,
right.
Exactly.
I mean, my expectations are high, so it will take a lot to raise them even higher. But get your name in for that drawing, which is tomorrow at 9 a.m. And also, if you call and decide to become a sustaining member, you can get some goodies. We have a KERA Care Pack, which sounds very caring. You can get three different things for becoming a member at a $20 a month sustaining membership level, and you'll get a t-shirt, KERA green t-shirt, which is organic cotton, and it shows your love for KERA and the environment, with a KERA iced coffee cup. It's a travel tumbler. I can hardly say that. It's a travel tumbler, and you get two reusable KERA shopping bags. And like Chris said, if you wear all three at the same time, the shirt, the coffee cup, and the shopping bags, you'll get some extra prize, and I'll think of that myself.
Or I think the universe is going to, like, put Ira Glass in your path. Yeah. Or,
or he'll pop out of the bag. Who knows?
Exactly.
Give us a call. You can get those goodies, or you can check out the other ones and get your name in for that Aretha Franklin drawing. The number's 1-888-694-6931, or you can go online, as always, to kera.org.
Really thankful to those of you who are making contributions today because, of course, we are still working on this challenge. We have 198 contributions left to go in order for the station to receive an additional $2,000. Your contribution in any amount counts. So maybe you're already a sustaining member, but you would love to see the station get an additional $2,000. You can you know, go back online or call on the phone and just, you know, kick in $10 or $20, or you can establish a membership and become like a real supporting member at a more significant level. We leave it up to you how much to contribute. Most people do about $120 a year, but it varies widely. There are people who give us thousands, and there are people who give us dozens of dollars.
Dozens, that's good.
But everybody, you know, everybody who believes in public radio is meant to come together and help to pay for it at kera.org or 888-694-6931.
This is a perfect time to contribute. And some of the people who've been, the phones are actually ringing quite a bit here. We have a thank you for Renee Lamb in Arlington, Texas. Elizabeth Benholm, or I think that I'm Benhalim, in Dallas. And we have Barbara Horton in Arlington. Thank you, thank you, and thank you. And then we also have a few more people. Mary Jean Garulo from Dallas, Kenneth and Claudia Aponte from Dallas, and Kathy and Joseph Van Blargen from Dallas. Quite a list of names growing. Join us. Join those people who you just heard who are part of the community, the public radio community. And you can join them by going online and contributing at kera.org or by giving us a call. We have friendly people waiting to hear from you. And again, that number is 1-888-694-6931.
Your contribution to KERA is really an investment in your own ongoing education about the world and about the way things work and about ideas. It's really like a wonderfully curated service that helps to open you up to a lot of things you might not have heard before. I'm constantly hearing about things on KERA because, of course, I listen when I'm not working on the station. And they cause me to want to sort of hunt down more information. And that's so exciting to me. And I love that the angle taken, Lauren, by you and other reporters on our team, but also on by the national folks, is very often different from what you might hear at every other media organization, which is not to say they're not doing good work. And we don't want to be disrespectful of our colleagues, but there's a different approach with public radio.
Yeah, there really is. And I think it's also an approach of giving the story its full amount of time and its full amount of coverage and opinions and really letting it sort of breathe a little bit more than having to get just a soundbite or having to stuff everything into a two-minute piece. So if you enjoy that type of radio where you're getting to go in depth on subjects and also have fun while doing so and learn something new, please join the community or renew a membership if you already have one. You can go online, you can check out the goodies, and again, if you pledge today, you can get your name in for a drawing for a pair of tickets to see Aretha Franklin. The number to call is 888-694-6931, or you can go online at kera.org anytime.
The difference maybe between KERA and even other broadcast news is that KERA is a little bit like taking your time with a really well-crafted, handmade meal and enjoying every bite and savoring it and thinking about the different flavors. And sometimes in other places, because of the kinds of constraints they're placed under by being commercial services, they are a little bit more like fast food that you eat while jogging out the door and trying to get nine things done. they both have their place, but public radio is different, and we do ask that you support it with your dollars so that we can continue to give you this alternative to everything else. You can do that at kera.org. You can also do it over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. KERA really needs your support if we are going to achieve this challenge of 2,000 additional dollars. We have 198 contributions left to go by 4 o'clock. Let's see if you can be the one to bring that number down. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Todd Miller, a journalist specializing in border issues who's written a book called Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Frontlines of Homeland Security. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. We had an email from Steve in Dallas who was curious about oversight of CBP, goodness, I have to get this right, Customs and Border Protection expenditures. Who's taking care of that, and who's monitoring how much money is going in and out?
Yeah, I believe there's a Homeland Security Committee that kind of monitors, there's a whole huge budgetary process that goes into it, and of course the president has to sign off on it. But there's also a committee, an oversight committee within Washington. I think I can't remember exactly what it's called, but it's like a Homeland Security Committee that does look at the different budgets and the budget expenditures.
But there are proposals on the table to continue to expand those budgets. Is that right?
Yes. For example, right now we're looking at every year. You can look year after year after year after year, and there's been an expansion of these budgets, especially CBP. And right now, in fact, because of some of these expanded budgets, they're actually hiring for 2,000 more new agents. So that's just that was a part of the fiscal 2014 year budget. So yeah, you see a constant expansion.
We have an email here from Tom in McKinney who says, recently I've read about CBP agents working with local law enforcement, intercepting private cars and aircraft, and doing warrantless searches and detaining U.S. citizens. These searches are not happening within 100 miles of the border, but deep in the country in states such as Kansas, Colorado, etc. Is this not a violation of the Fourth Amendment, and how does CBP continue to do these warrantless searches?
Yes, so the thing about the warrantless searches, they're definitely happening. Now, I have not heard of such searches happening deeper. One of the most famous ones is actually the Vermont senator, senior senator Patrick Leahy,
right?
He says that he was 150 miles south of the border in New York State, and he pulls up to a checkpoint, and the Border Patrol agent said, can you get out of the car? And he said, under whose authority are you? And the agent said, according to Leahy's rendition, he pointed to his gun and said, this is all the authority I need. That is one of the classic stories. And according to Leahy, he was outside of that 100-mile jurisdiction. But it is, it's not, you still have your Fourth Amendment rights to a degree, but it is altered. Maybe the word is mangled. It's not the Fourth Amendment. You are less protected within the Border Patrol jurisdiction than in other places. And I'm interested. I have not heard of CBP working in the middle of the country. What we do hear about is Immigration and Customs Enforcement working with local police agencies. There's all kinds of stories from coast to coast about people getting pulled over and for a number of different reasons. But there's all kinds of, what you hear about more in the interior of the country is this collaboration between ICE and local law enforcement. And the same sort of local law enforcement collaboration happens with CBP and Border Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, from what I know, within those 100-mile, or maybe a little bit blurry, maybe there's a little blurry area, but usually within those 100-mile jurisdictions.
And so there may be some confusion there. But so the Immigration and Customs Enforcement raids are looking for illegal immigrants, and they can operate anywhere in the country that they suspect someone is here without legal permission.
Right. So ICE is everywhere in the interior. The mission of ICE is a little bit different from Border Patrol, but you could simply state that it's almost like the transfer of what you would see on the southern boundary into the interior, that kind of similar kind of enforcement entrapment apparatus. And it relies heavily, heavily, heavily on police collaboration, whether it be secure communities or 287G agreements. And 287G agreements are the agreements that you're seeing less and less of them now, but they're the agreements which could give police, actual local police, immigration enforcement, an immigration enforcement mandate, so they can actually patrol and arrest people because of an immigration violation or something like that.
Probably won't surprise people, Todd, that there are tensions, particularly in areas that do fall within those, 25 and 100 mile barriers. There are, people who are residents of those areas that feel that CBP is overstepping its boundaries. Can you talk about some of the things the Border Patrol in particular is doing in order to curry favor with the local population, maybe create good relationships with young people?
Yes. Border Patrol and CBP, they have a number of what you could call public relations programs. One of the biggest ones, actually, is what you just mentioned. It's a program that they have with kids and teenagers, 14 to 21-year-olds, and it's through an Explorer program, which comes through the Boy Scouts of America. And the program is for teenagers to explore different career opportunities. One big part of it is law enforcement. And in the post 9/11 area, you're seeing more and more Border Patrol or CBP, what they call explorer posts. And if you go anywhere from Brownsville to San Diego, and from Detroit, Buffalo, Seattle, there are explorer posts with Border Patrol working working with kids, or it's like almost a youth group, so to speak, that will meet once or twice a week They'll learn all kinds of different, like the group that I was with was actually in El Paso, and the kids were telling me about the handcuffing techniques that they were learning. They learn about, you know, how do they go out to the desert, and they learn how to maybe, you know, interdict a drug smuggler, or they learn how to go after a terrorist. They learn how to go after people that are migrating without papers. They go to the checkpoints, like the different checkpoints, and get to play with the technologies at the checkpoints. And one real interesting thing that one of the agents, because they have the Border Patrol actually sends advisor agents. That's part of their detail. So maybe 3 days a week they're patrolling the line, the border line, and then 2 days they'll be working with the kids. Well, one of the agents told me, he said he used the metaphor, or he said, you know, we do the El Paso Thanksgiving parade every year, and before, you know, the Border Patrol, he meant, and the Border Patrol would only get a mixed reaction from the crowd, you know. He said, oh, it's the Border Patrol, so nobody would really clap. But then he said, well, then last year, and this was a couple years ago, last year we had the kids in the Explorer program march with us, and they marched in front of us, and they did some sort of takedown move as they were marching, and there was a wild applause, and there, you know, because each kid and their brothers and their sisters and their parents and their cousins and their, you know, their friends, and then he looked at me at the end of that story and he said, this is the key, quote unquote, the key to the community. So in other words, they look at, you know, one part of the kids programs is actually to identify kids who could be possible recruits in the future. Another part of it is definitely used to improve relationships with the community.
Were you able to come to a conclusion, Todd, about whether all of this enforced border security presence has in fact made us as a nation safer?
My conclusion is no. And you can look at that particular question. There's a number of different angles that you can look at that question. And one of the angles, definitely, I mean, the fact that the priority mission shifted to one of terrorism, yet there's not any real evidence that so-called, you know, people who are affiliated with terrorist organizations, known terrorist organizations, have been caught by, you know, the Border Patrol crossing our borders. You can look at it at that angle. Or you could also look at, and one of the angles that I look at in the book, actually via my hometown in Niagara Falls, New York, and if anyone's been to Niagara Falls, New York, you'll see that it's real different than Niagara Falls, Canada. Canada is where all the tourists go to. Niagara Falls, New York, banked on industry. But when I go to my hometown of Niagara Falls, New York, what I see now is a dying town, and it's a town where, you know, you practically fall into the potholes. It's a town where many of the factories have been shuttered. You see collapsing homes. You see budgets for basic services being cut left and right. You see a lot of poverty. There's about a 35% poverty rate. And you see housing, you know, housing budgets cut, education, health. And so one of the things I look at is this idea that we're looking at Homeland Security. And in Niagara Falls, one of the shiny new things that I see is actually Border Patrol, because Border Patrol has expanded there. And you see their technologies. And right down the road in Grand Island, which is right close to Niagara Falls, there's their operational control room. And they have a huge video wall, which agents look at. And they have the surveillance towers along the Niagara River and all this kind of expensive technology. And you see more and more agents. Yet, so you see kind of that buildup of budgets of Homeland Security versus a town that looks like it's falling apart, that's lost so much population, that has no employment security. And that really, really, I don't know if I come to a conclusion so much as raise that question, you know, what is, you know, where if we're looking at true security, where should our money truly be spent? And I try to look at that really, really, because you you don't have to only go to Niagara Falls. You can go to a number. I mean, you can go to any of the Rust Belt towns, or you can go to a lot of the U.S.-Mexico border towns, and you can go a lot of places. But that was the question that I wanted to really raise at the end of the book.
Todd Miller is a journalist specializing in border issues. His new book is called Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. Todd, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Yeah, no problem. It was a pleasure. It was an honor. Thanks.
Thanks to all of you for listening today. We really appreciate it. We especially want to thank those of you who have become members today, maybe for the first time, maybe you renewed at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931. If 197 of you would get in touch now and make a contribution in any amount, we would meet that challenge that we have to meet by 4 o'clock today. You only have to be one of those people. We have 197 to go. Once we're down to 196, and you have made your contribution, your part is done, and you can feel great, and you can sit back and relax and know that you are really a part of the formula of success for public radio. Lauren Silverman is back in studio now. Hi, Lauren.
Hello. And we have a few people that I want to give a special thank you who have called in just recently or gone online to KERA.org. Christina Duncan in Dallas, Ed Porter in Fort Worth, thank you, and Maria Corley in Lucas, Texas, which was a town I wasn't familiar with before this. So thank you so much for calling in and showing your support from across Dallas and Fort Worth. I asked for someone to call from Fort Worth, and look, we got one person. Thank you, all three of you. You can join these people and join the community of listeners who you may not see while you're listening to the radio, but who are there beside you enjoying the same content. The number is 888-694-6931, or you can go online to KERA.org, where you can also check out some of our goodies. Chris, we've got a few things that we're giving away.
We certainly do. We have tote bags. Yep. We have coffee mugs. We have T-shirts. We have books by both of our guests today, Anand Giridharadas. Anyway, we have The True Americans, excuse me. And we also have Todd Miller's book, Border Patrol Nation. Both of those are available as thank you gifts when you make a contribution at the $120 level. If you can't choose, just do $20 a month and we'll send them both your way.
Yeah, why choose one when they're both good? And also, if you get your name in and your call in or go online today, you will be entered automatically to win orchestra tickets to see the Queen of Soul, the legendary Aretha Franklin. And that's live at the Winspear Opera House on September 6th. The drawing deadline is tomorrow at 9 a.m. So please get your name in. And whether you were planning on attending or not, you're automatically entered to win. So it's a great opportunity. And you could be joined by fellow public radio fans there at the Winspear Opera House, just like you are every day when you turn on 90.1 KERA.
Somebody took the challenge because we're down to 196 that we need to go. Thank you, whoever you are. And we would love it if you would be the next person to take us down to 195 at KERA.org or by making a phone call to 1-888-694-6931. Perhaps you have been waiting for a sign that it's finally time for you to become a member. You know that you will eventually. Well, you know what? I'm going to read the tea leaves for you. Today's the day. Now is the time. There really is no better time in some ways. It's a little bit like, you know, people always say if you wait for the perfect time to have kids, you'll never have kids. You know, if you wait for the perfect time, I think it's always the perfect time. And if you wait for the perfect time
to have kids or to give.
Well, that's a whole other conversation. To give to KERA is always the perfect time. And honestly, it's the perfect time because it's, you know, you can adjust your membership based on your finances. So maybe you're at a great place in your life and maybe you could do a friend's membership and you think you ought to because you've been listening for years and years and you haven't joined up. You can do that now at KERA.org. Make a $1,500 contribution. If you're just starting out, you decide the amount. You can give at any level. We have all these suggested levels that come tied to thank you gifts. But the truth is, contributions in any amount are appreciated and go to paying for the programming that you value.
That's right. Any amount counts. Thank you so much for giving us a call or going online to KERA.org. And that number, again, is 1-888-694-6931.
You can also make a contribution at KERA.org and check out the thank you gifts there. There are a whole list of them, including books from both of our guests today. Please take action now in support of KERA, your public radio station. KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.